watching you from the control room and you look like you couldn't give a fuck. Do you want him to think you couldn't give a fuck? Really? That's how you want to do it? I was silent. Watching you and him is like watching fucking paint dry, he continued. I want to kill myself. You are boring me to death, and I know you're way more fun. If you're not into it, you can go home tomorrow if you want. You don't have to be here. Do you want to go home? No? Well, great. Why don't you show us that you're having a good time? Well, damn. That was aggressive. Suddenly, it was easy for me to imagine how you might say some fucked up shit on the show, no matter how sober, equanimous, or impenetrable you'd thought yourself to be. The power of suggestion is real, especially when someone is berating you and making you feel like a disappointment. And ladies, just imagine that in that moment, you were also on your period. That's right, the producers have been known to keep track of when the women in the house are menstruating, which often occurs simultaneously because that's what happens when women live together, so that they can schedule ITMs accordingly. When women cycled together in the house, it created a completely different vibe, producer Ben Hatta told me. The more dominant woman would basically set it off, and then another would come and say, I had my period 3 days before I came in the house, and now I'm having it again. What the fuck is wrong with me? So a girl's now crying mid-interview about nothing or being reactionary to things that are super small, he continued. It helped the producers because now you've got someone who is emotional and all you want is emotion. If a girl's feeling the butterflies for a guy already, when she gets into that state, her feelings just become more powerful, so she's probably more willing to tell that guy she loves him. And maybe one of the producers knew she was in that emotional state and was like, you know what? Now is a better time than ever. You should do it. You should do it. You should do it. In other words, when you see a contestant bawling on The Bachelor, they're often upset about something other than The Bachelor. Hatta explained it this way. Say he was talking to a girl about how she hadn't been on a date in 2 years. She starts reflecting on her love life, wondering if there's something wrong with her. Now she's tearing up. So then he would pivot the conversation towards The Bachelor, getting her talking about how much falling in love would mean to her after so many years of singledom. And all of a sudden, he said, she's the desperate woman. It's a tactic that bothered many former contestants I spoke to, including Brooks Forrester, who referred to the practice as emotional leveraging. They'd try to get me to talk about something from my childhood, for example, or something really personal about a family member, he recalled. Evoke this emotion out of you and then try to attach that to what's happening to the world of The Bachelor. In many ways, cast members ultimately fall in love not in a helicopter or a fantasy suite, but in the interview rooms. Think about it this way. You've come on a show hoping to fall in love. Well, maybe you're hoping for $1,000 a week from Sugar Bear Hair, but let's keep the intentions pure for the sake of this example. You're opening up about your hopes and dreams, describing your ultimate marriage partner. And there's this producer telling you that The Bachelor embodies all of the characteristics you're seeking in a man. That very producer is also starting to become someone you consider a close friend. Sure, they're there to do a job, but it really seems like they understand what you're going through. Relatability is one of the key attributes successful Bachelor producers possess. I spoke to one former segment producer who gotten married young when she was just 21. By the time she started working on the show, she'd had a husband for years, meaning she embodied so much of what the young women on the show aspired to. So I would allow them to talk, but I would make sure that I mentioned my husband in some way, she told me. I would take something that was their problem and put it on myself. There would be 20 minutes of me talking about myself, all unusable stuff. But then all of a sudden I'd go, I just want that for you because I know how special you are and I know you deserve this. The end game, she said, is getting a contestant to open up. To do that, the contestant must feel like they can trust you. And they're more likely to trust you if you're open with them about your own life, even though the details of your life as a producer will never be broadcast on national television. Not that every contestant bonds with their producer. On the contrary, things can often get testy between the two parties, especially when a producer is looking for a soundbite that a contestant is unwilling to give. During ITMs, producers will ask a question. Let's say, how important was this day for you? And a contestant is supposed to answer by using the question in a complete sentence. This day was really important for me because it was the first day I could really see The Bachelor being my husband. But sometimes you don't want to complete the question they're asking, explained Forrester. So I'd be like, what are you trying to get at? They tell me, and I say, cool, this is my own version of that sentiment. They'd always just continue to ask the same question formatted different ways, and it's like, I just told you I don't want to say that. You just reshaped the sentence and moved words around. Charlene Joint from Juan Pablo Galaviz's season became so resistant to what she felt were leading, obvious questions that a handful of producers were brought in to try to work with her. After her first one-on-one date in Seoul, she sat down for an ITM that should have lasted 20 minutes but ended up taking an hour. The problem? The producers wanted her to say she was falling in love with Galaviz, and she wasn't biting. The producer was asking, have you ever felt this way so soon? And I was like, yeah, she said with a shrug. I pretty much didn't give the answer they wanted at every turn, and the gist was definitely that I was not effusive enough. It became a big issue. Eventually, I was like, I don't know what you want me to say. It was a nice date. It was fine. I'm interested. It's been one real date. I'm not falling in love with him. I pretty much shut it down. In Seoul, she still had some fight left in her. But down the line, Joint said, she found herself so tired of the long ITMs that sometimes she'd kowtow to the producer's request just so she could get out of the interview room. Chris Bukowski did the same thing. I was saying lines verbatim from producers because I'd been sitting in a stupid room for an hour and just wanted to go, said the five-time franchise vet. You would say something you totally didn't even believe or want to say, but they just keep asking you and asking you and asking you, just like you're being interrogated. You see people who go to prison because the interrogation is so good that they're finally like, all right, I fucking did it. I mean, they put you in a room with no air conditioning, nothing to drink, and just ask you the same questions over and over. By the end of the day, you're like, shit, maybe I did do it. And then you're in prison for the rest of your life. Which, yes, sounds like hyperbole, but after thinking about it for a while and maybe watching a little too much of Netflix Making a Murderer, I realized Bukowski was onto something. So I went out and bought Police Interrogation and American Justice, the 2008 book by Richard A. Leo that explains the tried and true methods officers use to obtain confessions from potential criminals. And what I found, frankly, was kind of disturbing because the similarities between a police interrogation and a bachelor interview are rather striking. Let's start here. Before any accusation or confrontation, police seek to increase the suspect's anxiety by removing him from any social setting in which others could provide psychological support, Leo writes. Check. Bachelor contestants are always sequestered during their ITMs. Or, he continues, interrogators may try to make the suspect perceive that the interrogation will go on much longer, if not indefinitely, if he does not comply with their wishes. Sound familiar? If you don't say you're falling for Juan Pablo, Charlene, you might have to stay in this damn room all night. For suspects who are already sleep-deprived, fatigued, distressed, or suffering from physical discomfort, Leo writes, interrogation exacerbates these conditions. The need to escape may become so overwhelming that it overpowers any rational considerations about the effects of confessing. Yep, bachelor contestants are often coming into ITMs already tired, intoxicated, or upset. So why not just say what the producer wants and end the interview already? Interrogators may also alternate displays of sympathy with displays of hostility, positively reinforcing the suspect with friendliness when he says what they want to hear, but negatively reinforcing him with anger when he does not, the book says. This also rings true. Yes, producers sometimes go the tough love route, a la Carol, but on other nights, they're telling you how much they care about you and want you to find a husband just like they did when they were 21. And yet, despite all I'd heard about the captivating powers of Bachelor producers, it wasn't until I met Alon Gale that I saw it firsthand. Gale, the show's 34-year-old executive producer, is somewhat of a celebrity in Bachelor Nation, and even outside of it. He has more than 200,000 followers on Twitter, thanks largely to a comedic hoax he orchestrated called Diane in 7A. On Thanksgiving in 2013, back when he only had 30,000 followers, he started tweeting angrily about a woman on his flight who was supposedly being rude to a flight attendant. Fed up with her behavior, he sent alcohol and a stream of notes over to her row, one of which advised her, "Eat my dick." He also tweeted photographic evidence of the notes the two passed back and forth. The stunt went viral, but days later, just as a rumor began to surface on Storify that Diane in 7A had stage 4 small cell lung cancer, Gale admitted there was no Diane. No matter. He had already become an internet celebrity. Since then, he's befriended a handful of stars, including Chloe Grace Moretz, Kelly Oxford, and director James Gunn, who even gave him a tiny cameo in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. He dated Bachelor contestant Casey Stemer after she was eliminated from Ben Flanick's season, and his current girlfriend, a decade his junior, is former Castle actress Molly Quinn. He also has an eccentric look. His huge curly fro is reminiscent of Sideshow Bob from The Simpsons. He rarely seems to cut his bushy beard, and he loves jewelry, often sporting chunky rings on every finger, beaded bracelets, silver chain necklaces, and tiny hoop earrings. And sometimes it seems like there's nothing he won't share online, save, of course, for his secrets from the Bachelor franchise, which has employed him since 2009. He's documented a recent weight loss journey with shirtless selfies and photos from his scale. He stopped drinking in 2013 and often posts intimate blog posts about sobriety. "Why did I drink so much?" he mused on his Tumblr, All the Hate Mail, in 2015. "Because I wanted to feel everything, and when I was drunk, there was no barrier between me and my highs and lows. There was no filter. I was a corked bottle of emotion, crying for no reason and laughing for no reason and raging at the empty sky, feeling all of it." My first interaction with Gale occurred in 2011, not surprisingly, on Twitter. He must have stumbled upon the batch recaps I was writing for the paper because he suddenly posted this note. There's usually something endearing about Bachelorette recaps from at Amy K in LA. From there, we struck up a playful rapport. I'd hang out with him at Bachelor events in between interviewing contestants, and he even got Ben Flanick and Chris Harrison to crash one of my viewing parties, cameras and all. Sure, he'd rib me about my critiques of the show. "You don't need to be so snarky. You're smarter than that." But it always felt like he respected my opinion. That changed during Flanick's season in 2012, when ABC Publicity invited me to attend the Women Tell All taping. Along with a group of reporters, I sat on a cavernous soundstage watching the production, which was taking place a room over, on a monitor. No media were allowed to be in the studio audience. Flanick's season was a rather contentious one because he ended up proposing to the woman who had been cast as the villain, Courtney Robertson. As the season unfolded, however, it became clear that Flanick was unaware of just how unkind Robertson had been to the other women competing for his affection. All of the negative press about Robertson's conniving ways was starting to give Flanick second thoughts about his wife-to-be, and in a last-ditch effort to save the relationship, Robertson showed up at the Women Tell All to apologize for her behavior. During the Women Tell All, Robertson was very emotional, crying and asserting how she really is a good person. Then Chris Harrison had to cut to a commercial break. Some other reporters got up to grab some grub from Craft Services, but I stayed in my seat by the monitor. That's when I realized that the microphones on stage had accidentally been left on, and that I was now privy to what was meant to be a private conversation. Here's where Gail came in. He walked over to Robertson, who was dabbing her eyes with a tissue. "I didn't play with my hair once. Aren't you proud?" she asked him. "Yes," he replied. "That was good." She said she wished she could take a cigarette break, and they started discussing the brand she smokes, American Spirits, apparently. After a few minutes of this kind of banter, her tears had dried. "I'm not feeling very emotional anymore," she told Gail. "You made me feel better. I appreciate it, but I don't know if I can show that emotion again."
"You have to," Gail urged. "This is for you. This is for you and Ben."
Needless to say, after I published what I'd seen, Gail basically coaching Robertson to cry, he was none too pleased. Our relationship was never the same after that, and not long after, I found myself banned from bachelor events, though I have no idea if Gail was behind that or not. In the short time I spent with him, however, I was able to get a tiny glimpse of the power he holds over the contestants who go on the show. Multiple cast members I approached said they would be willing to speak with me, but were worried about saying anything negative about Gail for fear of losing his friendship. Flanick was one of them. He told me how much Gail had helped him move past his grief over losing his father, a struggle he spoke about openly during his season. "Alon was really instrumental in my life and talking through my feelings, whether it was for TV or not," said Flanick, who called from his home in San Francisco. "I looked at Alon as a therapist, almost. I enjoyed sitting down for multiple hours at a time with someone who would listen. I still genuinely value the time that we had together in talking about our lives and helping each other. Really," he insisted. "I think that's why we've maintained a friendship that's more than just surface level and skin deep." Even Charlene Joint, who seemed well aware of Gail's role in toying with her emotions during Galavisa's season, had mixed feelings about him. While she struggled to find common ground with many producers, he was the only one she really connected with. She relied heavily on Gail's guidance when she decided to leave the show prematurely, following his advice about how to make a smooth exit. In her journal, Joint wrote that Gail often told her she was his friend, one of his favorites, and reluctantly admitted that he'd become her personal coach, therapist, and bodyguard. "He's nothing short of brilliant," she wrote. "I didn't know how I was going to leave, and I was stressed out about it," she said of planning her exit. "I was like, America's gonna hate me." And he said, "If you listen to what I say, America will love you." There was one time where I was crying and asked him to give me a tissue, and he said, "No." I was like, "You're just gonna let me cry like this?" And he said, "Yes, America will love it." And he wasn't wrong. Viewers love tears. While Joint still harbors affection for Gail, Chris Bukowski has a harder time reconciling the producers' actions. As you know by now, Bukowski has been on the show 5 times, so clearly he's somewhat of a glutton for punishment. He went on both Bachelor in Paradise and its now defunct predecessor, Bachelor Pad, on which former contestants moved into the mansion to drink, hook up, and compete for a $250,000 prize. The first time Bukowski went on Bachelor in Paradise, he suffered a knee injury and had to leave the show early. Even though he'd only been dating a girl he'd met on the Mexico set for a few days, Elise Mosca, he nonetheless asked her to leave the show and travel back to Chicago with him. She obliged, and soon the couple was on a first-class flight back to Chi-Town. Once they arrived, Bukowski quickly began fielding calls from Gail, who wanted to know how things were going between the lovebirds. The producer asked the couple to send him home videos of themselves doing everyday things, Bukowski said. "Alon would call at midnight and be like, 'How you feeling about her? Do you think you would propose to her?'" Bukowski said. "I'm like, 'Alon, I don't know, man.'" Despite Bukowski's ambivalence about the new romance, Gail offered to fly him and Mosca back to Mexico. There, production would put them up in a local hotel suite until the final day of filming. That's when Bukowski would propose to Mosca with a Neil Lane ring. Bukowski didn't feel great about the plan, but he didn't know what else to do. After so many seasons on reality television, he'd badly tarnished his reputation, particularly on Bachelor Pad, where he hooked up with numerous women and seemed to have little regard for their feelings. If he proposed to Mosca, he reasoned, he'd look like a stand-up guy. Back in Mexico, Bukowski had daily meetings with Gail in which the producer would urge him to seal the deal with a ring. All right, listen, are you going to propose? Bukowski said Gail would ask. I flew out 2 rings. If you don't do it, someone else is going to. Are you going to do it? You've got to do it. This is going to fix your image so much. America's going to fall in love with you guys. Bukowski met with Neil Lane, who offered him a diamond to propose with. He took it back to his room for a night to mull over the plan, sleeping next to the ring box and a bottle of tequila. I'm thinking, holy crap, I've got to propose to this girl, he remembered. So I called my mom. I'm like, Mom, I don't know, should I propose to her? I don't, like, love her or anything. She's like, oh, son, do whatever you want. You have my support either way. At this point, she was probably just, like, so tired of all this shit. It wasn't the answer he was looking for, and his dad was no help either, advising him to just listen to his mother. Confounded, he told Gail he was ready to go through with the proposal. I knew, 100%, there was no way I could be with this girl, he admitted. I couldn't even stand her at one point. It was just so bad. But I honestly thought that me proposing to her and getting engaged on national TV was going to get people to forgive me for the way I acted in the past. The night before he was supposed to get down on one knee, Bukowski didn't sleep a wink. Mosca, who was totally in the dark at this point, kept asking him what was wrong. When it was finally time to get up, he thought he was having a heart attack. And just when he thought he might vomit, he ran over to Gail and said he couldn't go through with the plan. The producer sat down with Bukowski for an hour, trying to get him to change his mind, telling him how close he was to the finish line. If he got engaged to Mosca, the happy couple could return to Bachelor in Paradise the following summer to show off their success story. I'm like, Alon, I won't be with her by next season, Bukowski replied. I'd made up my mind. He could have fed me 20 drinks at that point. There was no way I was going to propose to her. As you might imagine, Bukowski doesn't pop up on Gail's Instagram feed these days. But plenty of other Bachelor contestants do, where the producer waxes poetic about the very same people he's convinced to cry on camera. He posts photos of himself hugging, carrying, and snuggling various cast members, some of whom he refers to as his children. I love everyone in this photo, and if you say something mean about them, I will kick you, he captioned one 2016 snap of him with 5 ladies from Ben Higgins' season. You can see how this all gets confusing. Does Gail really count cast members as his friends, or is he just doing his job? Can both simultaneously be true? You have to draw this weird line where you're kind of their friend, but you're not their friend, explained Hatta. You do care for them, in a sense, because you're learning all these things about them, and they're human. But at the end of the day, you are making television. So if you know a guy is going to break a girl's heart, you can't tell her. You have to build her up to where she's like, I'm going to go on this date and tell him I love him. Telling her she has to give her all when you know he's going to let her go and you have to let it play out. And getting too close to a producer can prove dangerous. No one knows that better than Craig Robinson, whose romantic relationship with a Bachelor staffer cost him a reality TV career and her a job on the show. After he was booted from Ali Fedotowsky's season of The Bachelorette, Robinson, who worked as a lawyer in Philadelphia, began negotiations to appear on Bachelor Pad. That's when he started talking to Carrie Lee Mastrangelo, an executive producer who'd been with The Batch since its inception in 2002. Mastrangelo was involved with casting Robinson on the second season of Bachelor Pad in 2011. During the casting process, he said, she began calling him every day, and the two started a flirtatious relationship. According to Robinson, Mastrangelo, who was married at the time, told him that he was the first cast member she'd ever been interested in, and that she wanted to help him win the show. She was like, you're a lot smarter than these other people, he recalled. I just kept thinking, if I can go on the show and have her in my corner the whole time, I could definitely win this thing. After completing the requisite drug and STD testing, Robinson was set to appear on the show. About a month before filming was slated to begin, he planned a trip to Los Angeles to visit a college friend.
When Mastrangelo found out he would be in town, Robinson said, she offered to pick him up from the airport. On the flight from Philadelphia to L.A., Robinson was so anxious that he drank a ton, and when he got off the plane, he immediately spotted the producer in baggage claim. She walks up to me and starts making out with me in the middle of baggage claim at LAX, he told me. I was like, oh my God, what the fuck is going on? And then she just basically didn't go home the whole weekend. Mastrangelo did not respond to my repeated request for comment. But according to Robinson, over the next 3 days, the two spent all their time together. Things got intimate, but they never consummated their relationship. And on his final night in town, Robinson and Mastrangelo decided to meet up with Alon Gale at a karaoke bar in the San Fernando Valley. The trio began drinking, and at one point, when Gale went to the bathroom, Robinson and Mastrangelo took the opportunity to kiss a bit. The makeout session lasted a little too long, though, because Gale returned and witnessed the two mid-lip lock. So Alon looks at me and says, "What the fuck was that?" Robinson remembered. He's like, "I've got to go home because what I just saw was not right. We'll talk about this tomorrow." The following day, Robinson got a call from Gale, who told the contestant he was going to have to report the hookup to Mike Fleiss. Mastrangelo was fired from the show, and Robinson was told he would no longer be a part of Bachelor Pad. He eventually returned to his law practice, and she has gone on to find other work in the television industry, working on programs like Celebrity Wife Swap. The two kept in touch for a while, Robinson said, but have not spoken in about 3 years. At least the two suffered ramifications of an actual romantic relationship. Just a year before Robinson and Mastrangelo's affair, Rosalind Papa, a contestant on Jake Pavelka's season of The Bachelor, was accused of having an inappropriate relationship with a producer that she still claims never even took place. It all began when Papa, who worked both as a model and a makeup artist, was filming introductory footage for the season. A producer named Ryan Callahan flew to Virginia to help production put together day-in-the-life footage of Papa and her son. Callahan was nice, Papa remembered, trying to ease her concerns about going on the show and telling her how great of a guy Pavelka was. She said this was the only time she ever spent alone with the producer. Cut to the second week in the house. Papa said she wasn't that into Pavelka, but otherwise, things in the mansion were par for the course. Then, just before a rose ceremony, Harrison pulled her outside to have a private conversation. "This is something we've never had to deal with in the history of the show," the host told her. "I am very sorry that we have to have this conversation. Rosalind, you entered into an inappropriate relationship with one of our staffers." Papa, looking flummoxed, remained silent. "That staffer is no longer working with us," Harrison continued. "Because of what happened, we feel it's now impossible for you to then now form a meaningful relationship with Jake. Out of respect for everybody here, the girls, Jake, yourself, this is something that we take incredibly serious for everyone on the show. And we feel like there was a line that was crossed with our staffer." "I'm not gonna say anything," Papa replied. "That puts me in a bad position." "The bottom line is this," Harrison said. "We feel, because of what has happened, it's impossible for you to continue on the show, and we feel that you need to leave tonight. Go pack your stuff, and then there's a van waiting for you." Reflecting on the exchange now, Papa said she was blindsided. She couldn't process what she was being accused of. "It was like he was speaking Portuguese," she said. She was so embarrassed that she'd been asked to leave that she didn't want to defend herself or beg to stay. Instead, she rushed to gather her things and exit as quickly as she could. In the hours following her departure, her mind began to clear, and she became increasingly angry. She was taken aback that the producer had fired Callahan, whom she'd viewed as a sort of confidant on set. No one from the show ever clarified what was inappropriate about their relationship, which she still insists was never sexual. That's not what Harrison says, though.
In numerous interviews as the season aired, he defined the relationship as physical, saying other girls on the show saw it and that Callahan confessed more than once and to more than one person. As for Papa, the only odd moment she recalls between herself and Callahan happened after she received the first impression rose on night one. Because the producer had encouraged her to pursue Pavelka, whom she wasn't excited about initially, she was eager to show him the rose. "I thought he would be really proud of me, so I took out the rose like, 'Look what I got,' she said. And he just scowled at me, turned, and walked away. I think my heart just sort of dropped at that point because I couldn't figure out why he was acting that way. Was he angry? Was he jealous? I think that there was definitely an interest on his end that hadn't been expressed before, and it was not something that I thought much of." After she was sent home, Papa got in touch with Callahan. She said she was confused by what had happened, particularly because neither of them had given production any reason to think they were more than friends. And he said, "Well, that's not true," Papa recalled. "I did talk to them because they could just see it on my face that I really cared for you in a way that I didn't care for the other contestants, and so I told them how I felt about you." Callahan did not respond to my request for an interview. To this day, Papa is still upset that he never stood up for her, but she thinks he probably remained quiet in the hopes of saving his television career. "You go on that show and you are meat for the grinder," Papa said with a sigh. "One way or another, they're going to make you good TV." The editing process, of course, is essential to shaping a narrative like this, and that takes place far from the mansion, done by staffers who never have any interaction with cast members. It all starts with loggers, employees who watch raw Bachelor footage and transcribe it all, replete with time codes. Those transcripts are given to story producers, who give the editors a sense of what they're looking for in an episode. The story producers break down each episode into acts. An act, which can be anything from a rose ceremony to an argument at the mansion, takes place between two commercial breaks. Even when that outline is in place, editors are still able to access the raw footage, usually as much as 2,000 hours worth of it. And that can be crucial when it comes to Frankenbiting, one of the main techniques editors employ to create certain narratives. A Frankenbite is a soundbite that has been recut so that it has a different meaning. Let's say The Bachelor says, "I do not want to go on a date with Trish." If an editor took out the words "do not," making the sentence, "I want to go on a date with Trish," that would be a Frankenbite. "With editing, everything is malleable," said one editor who worked on the show for 3 seasons. "You can make it whatever you want. You think, 'Oh, she's going to say something bitchy and we'll use that.' No, no, no. You make whatever she does bitchy." Even without Frankenbiting, there are ways to recontextualize scenes. Imagine that a story producer hands over footage from a one-on-one date between a woman and The Bachelor. The date went pretty well, but the editor is told by a story producer to make it seem like the couple went on the worst date in history. The date lasted 3 hours. Sure, The Bachelor and his lady had plenty of conversations, but the editor isn't going to showcase any of those. Instead, he's going to take the shots where they're both sitting in silence. Maybe he'll throw in one where the woman takes a prolonged sip of wine from her glass. Even though The Bachelor told his date, "We really have a lot to talk about," the editor will Frankenbite the clip, turning it into, "We don't really have a lot to talk about." And then, that edited soundbite will be layered over footage in which you don't need to see The Bachelor's mouth moving. A shot of the ocean view, perhaps, or of the tiramisu no one has touched. And voila! Instead of a 3-hour gab fest, the date has transformed into 20 seconds of total awkwardness. "I'm thinking, this is what I want to happen. Then I make the footage tell that story," the editor told me. "I don't care what actually happens. It's like I'm handed a big bucket of Legos and think, what do I want to build today?" "There's no allegiance to what happened in reality," he said. "The only things that are definitely happening are the rose ceremonies. The only other goal is entertainment, and that's why the show is successful." Claire Crawley learned that the hard way.
When she was on Bachelor in Paradise, editors made her the butt of a joke by making it seem like she was confiding in a raccoon. Yes, you heard that correctly. After some house drama, Crawley went outside to cry and vent to someone, a fellow castmate, perhaps even a producer, but editing made it appear as if she were talking to a wild animal. Though the bit was clearly meant to be comedic, Crawley said she's encountered many viewers who took the gag seriously. "People message me and say, 'You're so psycho. I can't believe you talk to raccoons,' she said. I'm like, 'I'm the psycho one, me, or the person who actually thinks that I talk to raccoons?' People are clueless to editing." Though she long felt that the editors on the show were like the man behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz, she actually met the man responsible for the raccoon cut at a wrap party for Paradise. He was like, "Just so you know, I'm the one who put the raccoon stuff in there," she said. I was literally like, "Really? You're owning up to that? Do you know how much grief you caused in my life from people actually thinking I was talking to raccoons?" Which, yes, it's probably not fun to have people thinking your BFF is a raccoon, but Bachelor edits have had far more serious repercussions. Flanick, for one, still blames the editors on his season for the demise of his relationship with the so-called villainous Robertson. While he came off looking fine, they're never gonna make the main person look bad, right? I mean, you're the knight in shining armor. He feels the show went to extreme lengths to make his one-time fiancé appear evil. You do all this work for everyone for so long, and it's like, this is the end product you decided to display to the entire world? Said Flanick. I felt super emasculated. It was like, God, that's not really how I remember it, but that's how everyone else is gonna see it, and that sucks because that's not who I really am. I'm not saying I want to be in a relationship with Courtney, he clarified, but I blame the higher-ups in production for the way they handled and portrayed our relationship. And that's why Mike Fleiss and all of them don't reach out to me. They know I don't want anything to do with the franchise. Robertson declined my interview request, but in her 2014 book, I Didn't Come Here to Make Friends, Confessions of a Reality Show Villain, she talks about how producers relished her over-the-top antics. A few weeks into filming, she wrote, the team already recognized she was a loose cannon, especially after a glass of wine. As time went on, and as it became clear that Ben liked me and I'd be sticking around for a while, I got pulled into confessionals and found myself trying to be a comedian on camera, doling out increasingly outrageous insults, she wrote. That's the interesting thing about contestants who end up fulfilling specific Bachelor character types. The villain, the drunk, the virgin, the Southern Belle, the aspiring musician. A lot of them cop to their part in the creation of those roles. Remember Erica Rose, the tiara-wearing wannabe princess whose daddy was a plastic surgeon? Even though she knew she'd come off looking like a spoiled brat by wearing tiara headbands, she decided that going along with the producer's costume suggestion was a better idea than ignoring it. If you don't go along with them, they're going to portray you that way anyways, so essentially, I just allowed it, she said with a shrug. When we were moving into the mansion, they told me to go up to Chris Harrison and complain about the fact that there weren't any maids. At first, I didn't want to, but then I realized it would be funny. I feel like I was in on everything, so I didn't feel exploited in any way. Same thing for Justin Rated R Rigo, the former wrestler who left Ali Fedotowsky season after it came to light he was making phone calls to an ex back in Canada. No surprise here, he was a villain. Even though Rigo hadn't wrestled professionally for more than 2 years when he applied to be on The Bachelorette, in fact, he was the assistant manager at a fitness club, he still threw his alter ego's name on the form to spice up the otherwise vanilla application. On his first night in the mansion, Rigo said, producers asked if he'd put his Rated R t-shirt on under his dress shirt. As soon as he exposed it to Fedotowsky, he became enemy number one in the house, the guy who looked like he was just on the show to advance his career. So later that evening, when Harrison asked the cast to vote for the contestant who was here for the wrong reasons, Rigo won out. That's when I realized, oh, I'm that guy this season, he said. I was so blown away that everything was going to come down on me. So it was like, if this is how the storyline is going to be, I'm going to make this a damn good storyline. Let's do it. So in ITMs, when producers would ask him to answer a question as if he were his bombastic rated R character, he went with it. One day, he said, Gale asked if he'd be interested in spending a little extra time with Fedotowsky. Let's say we let you leave the house and you walk to her house. Is that something you'd be open to? Even though he was on crutches at the time, which would obviously make walking a challenge, Rigo responded that it would be dope to see more of The Bachelorette. So Gale revealed his plan. While Fedotowsky's residence was just up the street, Rigo was driven 45 minutes away to a curvy cliffside road. There, he was told to get out and hobble down the street on his crutches as the cameras rolled. The scene would later be used to make it look like Rigo had gone to extreme lengths to see his love interest. But in fact, he was just chauffeured over to her place later in the day. I know the importance of a storyline, he said, explaining why he went along with the scheme. There were some nice, great human beings on that show. You, the viewer, never saw them. If I'm going to be on a show like that and get that once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, I'm going to make the best of it. With the producers, you can either cooperate with them and stay on the show and have all these great things happen and have these stories 60 years later to tell my kids, he said. Or you can not cooperate and be like, no, I don't want to say that. I don't want to do this. And then it's like, okay, we're not going to film you and you're going to get eliminated. The most brusque producers will admit as much too. They don't follow a handbook of moral guidelines. As far as they're concerned, once a cast member signs on the dotted line, anything is fair game. Look, I don't want to see anybody get hurt, said Scott Jeffress, but I do want to make good television, and if somebody's feelings are hurt, I'm sorry, you signed up for it. I'm very adamant about having cast embrace the show that is shown on television. In other words, look, you may have said this a little differently than what it appears to be in the cut, but that's what the viewer heard, so embrace it. Own it. This is you. I don't put up with a lot of cast members saying producers made me do this or that. I'll get on the phone, call them up and say, they didn't make you say anything. We asked a question and you answered it, okay? Jeffress, who now works as an EP on MTV's dating show Are You the One, says everyone in the reality television industry is constantly trying to push the boundaries. And with every year that passes, contestants become more willing to expose their minds and bodies. I mean, look where we are. I've got people having sex on camera. I can't show it, but they're having it, he said. If it was legal to put electrocutions on TV, they'd be doing it if it garnered ratings and if advertisers would sponsor it. That's really where the moral standard lies, with the advertisers. They'll pull sponsorship from a show that they think goes too far. But advertisers are flocking to The Bachelor. Why I'm a fan. Paul Scheer. I'm a latecomer to The Bachelor game. I would say Ben Flanick was kind of my entry point season when I began loving the show because he was a terrible bachelor. I used to think with guys like Andrew Firestone, oh yeah, that guy looks cool. And now it seems like they're like, fuck it, let's just have fun with these dummies. No offense to anybody, but one of the bachelors lived at home with his parents. That's not the prize you want to put on TV. None of these people are prime husband material anymore. There's a voyeuristic quality to the show that is so fun. You go, oh my gosh, what would it be like if I was in that situation? Why are they reacting like that? Why are they doing this? You're constantly putting yourself in their position, which makes it, in a weird way, aspirational. We've all dated. It's the only thing that we can all do equally, that we're all experts in. I'm not an expert on how to build a fire or a hut on Survivor. I can't sing or tell you if someone is off pitch, but I can tell you, oh, that girl's going to be trouble, or that guy's a dick. I think that there's always a turned-up nose at the franchise because if you haven't watched it, you have an assumption of what it is. On Howard Stern's show, they give him so much crap for being a fan. The listeners call about it and they complain about it. But whenever someone makes fun of people watching The Bachelor, I'm like, well, you haven't watched it then because I used to feel the exact same way. I've been with my wife now for 13 years, so I'm so far out of the dating pool, it's ridiculous. And it's funny to see the current dating world vicariously and talk about it together. We argue about who the best person on the show is, she'll shoot down who I like, and vice versa. And then it's like, well, wait, if you don't like that person on the show, why do you like me? You can't just dip your toe in. It will take me like 6 months to get through an hour-long drama that I have all lined up, but I can watch a Sunday to Monday night of The Bachelor and it's like cotton candy. You eat it, it's delicious, it disappears. Where did that go? I can't believe I watched 4 hours of it. I think it's the best produced reality show on television, hands down. They've been doing the same thing over and over again, essentially, for 35 seasons. But you're always invested. It may get predictable, but that predictability doesn't make it boring. Chapter 8. Under the Covers. After Claire Crawley's father died, she started to feel anxious all the time. She didn't feel comfortable leaving her house. The thought of driving on the freeway made her jittery, and getting on a plane, she wouldn't even consider it. So signing up for The Bachelor represented more than just taking a shot at love. Going on the show meant she was trying to conquer her anxiety, ridding herself of her fears by facing them head on. Still, before she flew from Sacramento down to Los Angeles to meet Juan Pablo Galavis, her sister gave her one Xanax pill, folded up in a tissue. Keep this in your pocket, and if you ever get in a situation where you start to panic, you'll be okay, Crawley's sister advised. But she never ended up swallowing the pill, because once she got on the show, her nerves started to dissipate. By the time production traveled to Vietnam, Crawley was astounded at how far she'd come. I started sobbing because I was like, I wish my dad could see me here. I wish he could see me without anxiety and know what I'm feeling, the most free feeling in the entire world. To commemorate the moment, she decided to ask the producers if she could go for a late-night swim in the ocean. It was well after midnight, and she wasn't supposed to leave her hotel room. Absolutely, she said they responded. But Juan Pablo's the reason that you're here, so do you want to share that moment with him? She liked the idea, so she and a camera crew wandered over to the bachelor's room around 4 a.m. Despite the hour, he was game for an adventure. The two ran down to the beach and hopped in the water. Crawley said she was crying and he hugged her, saying how happy he was to be able to share the moment with her. Then they went to bed, separately. But when the ocean encounter played out on television, it appeared far more scandalous. There was lots of kissing, and it looked as if the couple potentially had sex in the water. I felt like I was kicked in the stomach because that had been one of the best, greatest feelings in my entire life, feeling that sense of relief from anxiety, Crawley said of watching the episode. I felt so betrayed by the producers. You put in slow motion, sexy music, muffled sound, and it seems like, oh my God, what's happening? Nobody gives two shits about somebody overcoming anxiety. I think that's so much more relatable, but of course, they have to make it look like drama. Things only got worse from there. Shortly after the late night swim, Galavis confessed to Crawley that he felt guilty about their ocean dip. That was good, but at the same time, it was kind of a little weird for me, he told her. To me, it's hard, this whole situation, because I have a daughter. I don't want her to see what happened. If she sees it, I don't think it will be that nice. Taken aback, Crawley started crying, saying she hadn't intended to disrespect his daughter. Not only, according to her, had nothing sexual occurred between her and the bachelor, but Galavis hadn't hesitated to go to the beach with her. And now, after the fact, he was trying to make it seem like she'd lured him into some scandalous trap. In any other position, I would have looked at him and been like, first of all, there was nothing wrong with what happened, she said. I was trying to look at it from his perspective, like, okay, maybe he did feel bad. But now I look back on it and I'm going, hey, bro, you could have said no. I was so crushed because he had essentially taken that moment away from me. The incident marked a watershed moment on The Bachelor, one of the first times two cast members appeared to have sex prior to the fantasy suite. Since the program's origin, sex has typically been reserved for the fantasy suite, rose-laden luxury hotel rooms that the final three contestants get to spend the night in, separately, if they so choose. The special evenings take place after hometown dates, but before anyone gets down on a knee, therefore becoming the last opportunity for the finalists to sleep together before getting engaged. The fantasy suite dates don't actually occur over three consecutive nights. There's a day filled with interviews in between each romantic night. But in theory, the bachelor or bachelorette could still be having sex with three different people in the span of a week. A situation that wouldn't fly with most fledgling couples outside of the batch. I was like, could I have set something up like this in college where I could date 27 girls and they're all cool with it? Said Lorenzo Borghese, the Italian prince who was the ninth bachelor. It's kind of like watching boxing where you see a guy getting beaten in the head, but you're cheering. If the guy were out here on the street, you try to break it up. But when it's treated like, hey, this is the game, you accept it. Early on, however, producers weren't sure how accepting contestants would be of the fantasy suites. Women, in particular, struggled to compartmentalize the idea that The Bachelor had just been intimate with another woman, said Scott Jeffress. Women really felt like it was creepy and weird, the producer recalled. So you just have to say, look, this is just the way the show works. It's not his fault. Are you feeling it? Do you feel like you're ready to go to that level yet? Because now's your chance. Just saying. And once they get on the date with him, it all goes away. It's their world, and there's no one else there. There was more resistance to it in the beginning, and then it lessened, agreed Michael Carroll. Girls just got more understanding of what it is. If you come and you're final three and you want to lock it down, there you go. Of course, there are no explicit rules forbidding anyone from sleeping together earlier in the season. But if you have sex before the designated time and outside of the designated place, there's a good chance you'll be treated like Crawley was. If Claire had bided her time and waited however many episodes until Juan Pablo invited her into his fantasy suite, wrote Slate's television critic Willa Paskin, she would have been celebrated as a woman willing to make herself vulnerable for love. Instead, she got the easy woman edit and a scolding about sexual propriety from a guy proudly wearing multiple women's spit. It may be hard out here for a pimp, but it's way harder for a bachelorette. That was especially evident when Caitlin Bristow had her turn as the leading lady in 2015. Early on, Bristow made it clear she was a rule breaker when she let Nick Viall join the cast of men competing for her affection. Viall had just come off Andy Dorfman's Bachelorette, and after he was sent home as the runner-up, he and Bristow struck up a flirty friendship. They exchanged messages online and spoke on the phone, and when Bristow was selected as the Bachelorette, Viall decided to throw caution to the wind and turn up on the show again, and she allowed him to stay. Viall's late arrival instantly stirred up controversy. The other men were displeased that someone Bristow had a prior relationship with had been allowed on the show at the last minute. And to make matters worse, she seemed insanely attracted to him. We'd spent 5 weeks doing nothing but talking to each other beforehand, Viall later explained to me. The physical part was playing catch-up to the emotional. There's a reason why we looked like we wanted to rip each other's clothes off, because we fucking did. Which explains why, after a one-on-one date in Dublin that consisted almost entirely of making out, Bristow asked Viall to spend the night at her hotel. Though viewers only saw a closed bedroom door, revealing subtitles, Viall, I want to know every part of you, hashtag shudder, and heard moaning, which made it obvious what was going down. But the next day, instead of celebrating her sexual escapade, Bristow looked forlorn. She still had half a dozen men left in the competition, and she felt things went too far with Nick.
And it's not about me feeling bad that I was intimate with him, she insisted in an ITM. I feel bad that I have relationships with these other guys that are so great and mean so much to me. Later, during a heart-to-heart with Chris Harrison, she confessed she'd had sex with Fayal. To be honest, I was kind of disappointed in myself, she told the host. After my one-on-one, we went back to my hotel and I just really regret it. Well, that's good, Harrison replied, insinuating that her behavior was, in fact, regrettable. We all screw up, and the way I feel is, where do you go from there? That's a sign of good character. Eventually, she told Sean Booth, the man she'd end up engaged to at the end of the season, about her relations with Fayal. Though he had a difficult time accepting the news, obviously Booth was able to move past the admission. America, however, couldn't seem to look past Bristow's pre-fantasy suite rendezvous. When Bristow sat down with Harrison during the Men Tell All episode after the season wrapped, she revealed that she was being bullied online by those who disagreed with the way she'd conducted herself on The Bachelorette. The host proceeded to read some of the mean stuff that had been directed towards Bristow, including a tweet calling her a whore and an email that said she had no morals and should just crawl in a hole and die. I hope the fans break her spirit so that our kids can see that whoring behavior isn't rewarded. Andy Zeisler, co-founder of the nonprofit feminist organization Bitch Media, believes the vitriol stemmed from the discomfort many viewers still have with the idea that women have the capacity to date and have sex without emotional attachment. People are very threatened by the idea that that is actually something that occurs and has become a pretty standard part of contemporary dating life, said Zeisler, also the author of We Were Feminists Once. And the show made the entire storyline that season about the fact that she had slept with one of the suitors too soon. It became such a central storyline in a way that it never had and never would on The Bachelor. Conversely, if a contestant makes it clear they won't be having sex due to religious or moral beliefs, that also garners a lot of attention. Sean Lowe was dubbed the Virgin Bachelor on the cover of Us Weekly after he declared he didn't plan on sleeping with anyone on the show. He wasn't technically even a virgin. He had recommitted himself to Christ after a few premarital encounters and vowed to remain celibate until he walked down the aisle. Nonetheless, the idea that a 20-something bachelor would pass up the opportunity to hop into bed with a handful of ladies proved to be juicy tabloid fodder. The girls are stunned to learn Sean's saving himself for marriage, Us Weekly's 2013 headline continued, promising to explain how awkward the fantasy suite dates were and how the winner copes with her sexless engagement. While he may have made headlines, unlike Bristow, Lowe was embraced by Bachelor Nation because of his beliefs. I think a lot of people found it refreshing, he said. Like, wow, okay, so this show doesn't necessarily have to be on the scandalous side. Here's a guy that believes what I believe, and he's kind of a stand-up guy. He's not ashamed to say that he's not handling the fantasy suites the way that most people do. Heading into the show, Lowe said he knew he wanted to make his intentions clear to both the women on the show and Bachelor fans. Whether he liked it or not, he said, he knew people would be looking up to him, and he wanted to represent himself and his faith accurately. Desiree Siegfried, who was also a practicing Christian, felt the same way when she was Bachelorette. I would never go have sex with three different guys. Actually, wouldn't condone it, she said. I love girls like Andy and Caitlin because they are like girl power and whatever. But you are on TV, so regardless of if you want to be a role model or you don't, you are one. 10-year-olds are going to watch you. We shouldn't just give in to so many guys. We need to be empowered in the way of, yeah, the guy is going to pursue me, but I don't need to give it up. Regardless of your gender, Lowe argued, having sex on all your fantasy suite dates is unhealthy. And it can cause trouble down the line. Even if you end up with the fantasy proposal that everybody wants at the end, he said, then you're left answering questions with your new fiancé about why you did those things. Maybe that's my personal convictions, but sleeping with three people in 3 days can't be good for you. And yet, if you watch The Batch, you're probably under the impression that most finalists have sex in the fantasy suite. Of course, plenty do, often because they're so worked up after weeks of unresolved sexual tension. People underestimate how horny you get, one Bachelor contestant told me. What I cannot believe is that more people did not bring vibrators. You're in these constant situations where there's a lot of buildup, there's a lot of making out, and then you're pulled away from each other. After a while, I just wanted to